Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Few would argue that any business is harder to succeed in than the restaurant business. On this week's show, we'll hear some of America's greatest success stories from the hospitality world. Danny Meyer, CEO of the Union Square Hospitality Group, joins us to reveal the secret of his success, something he seeks in every employee he hires, the HQ. That's the hospitality quotient. Then we'll meet one of the folks with a very high HQ, Thibodeau-born Jean-Paul Bourgeois, Danny's executive chef at New York City's Blue Smoke. And any business that's been around since 1837 is obviously doing something right. Chef Billy Oliva and Karen Serafin reveal the delicious history from America's oldest restaurant, Delmonico's. Food, hospitality, and good drink. We've got it all for you on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Hi, I'm Danny Meyer, and I'm the founder of Union Square Hospitality Group, and always happy to be in New Orleans, and especially with Poppy.
When it comes to opening successful restaurants with a focus on customer satisfaction, Danny Meyer is peerless in his field. Writer, restaurateur, and CEO of Union Square Hospitality Group, Danny's won a staggering 26 James Beard Awards for his family of New York City restaurants. A hallmark of his success is Danny's gold standard of hospitality. We had the honor of sitting down with Danny to hear his thoughts about what's truly important in creating a successful restaurant business. Danny, this is such an honor. I can't believe that I'm able to have this interview with you and let my whole Louisiana Eats audience get a taste of what an incredibly special, gifted person you really are. I would like you to start off by telling me what New Orleans and the New Orleans hospitality scene mean to you, because that's your key operating word, hospitality.
Well, the hospitality and gastronomy is so amazing here that I have to be careful how often I come. Seriously, I just do nothing but consume the entire time I'm here because it just feels so good. It tastes so good. Everybody's so nice. Everybody. I mean, taxi drivers, you learn their life stories. You know, the guy at the hotel who gets you the taxi, you learn his life story. And it just feels great. And you know, it's such an authentic American city. It's one of those very, very few places that when you're there, there's just nowhere else on earth you could be. We don't have that many cities like that, but New Orleans has it all.
I know that every single level in every one of your businesses, the customer's experience is always paramount. So how do you find those people, and how do you train them?
Well, the thing that we've learned through the years is that the one thing you can train for is how to identify people who have the natural gift for hospitality. But we've never learned how to train people who don't have the natural gift for hospitality how to have it. So what we've been able to do is to identify five or six emotional skills that are almost always present at a very high level in somebody who's got what we call a high HQ, high hospitality quotient. And that's somebody who's, regardless of what their job is, whether they're a bartender or a grill cook or a maitre d', they've got to be really good at what they do. But more importantly, someone with a high HQ is coming to work concerned about how they're making someone else feel. And yeah, they want to be the best at what they do, but they come from a spirit, first and foremost, of, okay, when I'm doing that thing I do so well, how did I make the person on the receiving end feel? And we've gotten pretty good at identifying what the emotional skills are that are always present. And we do know how to teach that. And we also know how to celebrate when people who have a high HQ express it to our guests. What we've just never succeeded at, though, is if you're not a nice person, we don't know how to make you nice.
Could you tell me what those six emotional skills are? Because obviously, if there's six and you can count them, you must be able to
name them off. I know exactly what they are. And, you know, without giving a shameless plug for my book, Setting the Table.
I was going to bring up Setting the Table.
I was just going to say I go into them all in great depth there. But I can rattle through the six of them real easy. The first one is someone who is kind and optimistic. You would be surprised how skepticism and negativity and the glass is half empty does not work in hospitality. So you want optimism and you want someone who's kind. Secondly, you want somebody who is really curious about learning. Somebody asks good questions like you do. Somebody who walks a different street every day just because they might just learn something new. Third, you want somebody who's got a great work ethic. We do know how to teach people how to do their job, the stuff they do pretty well, but we don't know how to teach people how to care about doing it as well as it can possibly be done. And then fourth, we look for people who are enormously empathetic, people who are aware of the wake that they leave in their path when they go through life and who care about how they make other people feel. That's sort of an obvious one. And they care how other people feel. And then the next one is self-awareness. We want people who realize that just like the weather changes every single day, we all wake up feeling slightly differently every single day, and we want people who are aware of what's going on inside of them because hospitality is a team sport, and it's really important to know how your own emotional weather report is going to make other people feel. And then the sixth one, which is so hugely important, is integrity. And that's somebody who has the judgment to do the right thing, even when no one else is looking. So I know that sounds like an awful lot right there, but if you had someone who was the best pasta maker in the world and yet they weren't nice, I don't want to hire them. Or if you had somebody who's the best grill cook in the world, but they don't have a great work ethic, I don't want to hire them. On the other hand, if you get someone who's awesome at what they know how to do, and who's doing it because they want the product of their work to make you feel better than you otherwise felt, that works every single time. You just can't lose.
How many employees do you have now company-wide?
One for every gray hair on my head. Actually, I think we're probably north of 1,500 employees right now. And in all seriousness, I think that when we go to work, it's really with a spirit of what's called servant leadership. And everyone knows that I'm the boss of the company, but I also realize that my highest order of responsibility is to create a work environment that makes work feel like you're coming to play. And therefore, my job is to serve our employees so they can do an even better job of serving our guests.
Another fascinating aspect of your business to me is that, so you've got these great employees and you're an incredible leader for those employees, but over the years, you have so drastically diversified your businesses from a very, very fine dining white table Union Square to a Shake Shack or a Blue Smoke, all those different elements. What made you go from one point to another? What made you do that stretch?
So you're asking a great question, Poppy. And, you know, I've actually spoken to business consultants who have asked that question in a way that makes me feel like I'm doing something wrong. Because, in wise business circles, you should really have the discipline to focus on doing one thing that you do better than anybody else as well as you can do it. And I finally came up with a good answer for myself. I don't really care if I satisfy them. And that's that we only do one thing. And the one thing we do is hospitality. And the fun is, and in fact, my passion is to test out, is the power of hospitality so strong that you can actually leverage it over all kinds of different businesses? And at the same, so for example, I would say if you take a company like Heinz, which is famous for 57 varieties, do they have 57 different businesses, or do they have one business that has 57 different ways of expressing that one real mission of the company? And so I think that in our case, you know, we love our restaurants that have stars in the New York Times and Michelin, high ratings in the Zagat survey. In fact, we just opened a new one a few weeks ago called Untitled, which is at the brand new Whitney Museum, which is doing really, really well. But it's equally satisfying to see that at any price point, with any menu, and with any mood, people want to feel like you're happy to see them, and they want to feel welcome. And it's really fun to play that one business out over many, many different ways of expressing it.
My baby don't care for rings or other expensive things. My baby just cares for me.
When we come back from a short break, Danny talks about his restaurant, Blue Smoke, and the role it's played in New York's burgeoning barbecue scene. Stay tuned.
His baby don't care for shows. His baby don't care for clothes.
My baby just cares for me.
Nobody else will do.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Our conversation with hospitality guru Danny Meyer continues. I'm very curious, you know, you've got so many restaurant businesses and now a bar also in New York. And, of course, there's the Shake Shack. That's a phenomenon that's been just turning my head from a distance. When you're in New Orleans, what have you taken back to New York with you?
Well, let's start with a guy who's the chef at Blue Smoke and who's also responsible for the food at our bar, Porchlight. Jean-Paul Bourgeois, who's from Thibodaux, Louisiana. And I can't say that I took him from New Orleans, but I can say that the flavors that I love so much in New Orleans that taste so amazing when you're here, but often don't taste quite as good when somebody, especially someone from the North, tries to appropriate them and serve them in the North, as close as we could come was to have someone on our team who's not cooking New Orleans-style food because he once had it here and thought he could sing the song to New Yorkers, but rather somebody who grew up with it, with his family of cooks and butchers, and somebody who's really, really cooking from his heart. So I'm a big believer that hot dogs always taste better at the ballpark, and there's just no way you're going to get a po' boy to taste in New York like it does here in New Orleans. But we can come pretty close with a guy, you know, who grew up here, who makes his own andouille, he makes his own jerky, and I think he learned a lot of those things from his family. When we opened our barbecue restaurant, Blue Smoke, this goes back to 2002, I was just completely taken aback by the amount of almost anger from the restaurant critic community who were basically saying, you guys are really bad, number one. Number two, how dare you try to bring a taste of the South up to New York City? You don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what you're doing. And it wasn't just restaurant critics. I think at the beginning, we found ourselves by trying to bring something to New York that hadn't really been there, authentic pit barbecue. We found ourselves in a crossfire of people, you know, the people from Texas tasted our version of something from Memphis and didn't like it, and the people from Memphis tasted something, you know, which was our version of North Carolina and didn't like it, and the people from Kansas City said, you're not putting enough sauce on the ribs. And I had people sending me, I had regular guests of our restaurants sending me their favorite barbecue sauce from their hometown, which was better than ours. I had people sending me their grandmother's recipe for coleslaw, which was better than ours. And I think what I realized, I was surprised, but now I get it, is that food has such wonderfully emotional, evocative strings on people because food is love. It's really the first gift of love that we got outside of a hug. And barbecue restaurants or any restaurant that harkens back to where you grew up and how you grew up and what you were fed and how you were loved is so intertwined with all those feelings. And so if you monkey around with the kind of dishes, whether it's potato salad or coleslaw or deviled eggs or blueberry pie or banana cream pie, that people grew up knowing one way, and generally it was made by their mom or their grandmother, you're messing with their heartstrings. And so I think the big aha moment in the face of all this was, number one, stay the course, just keep making the product better, which we have. And number two, for the first time in my life, I came to the conclusion that the goal was to be everybody's second favorite, because I wasn't going to compete with grandma, that was for sure.
Well, what you did even beyond that is you stayed the course. It's a very successful, renowned restaurant now, but you also somehow morphed this barbecue thing into the Big Apple Barbecue, which is an enormous festival now. So that was really like a kind of gotcha, huh?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that you know about that, but it really wasn't a gotcha. We started the Big Apple Barbecue Block Party almost as a defense mechanism because of all this criticism. It hurt. It hurt because we had really put in a lot of research. We had made a lot of friends along the barbecue trail, 60,000 miles collectively, learning in every barbecue community. And what we decided to do was just to sort of silence some of our critics. We didn't want to say gotcha, but we just kind of wanted to neutralize the playing field. So we invited four of our favorite pit masters to come cook on the block right outside of Blue Smoke alongside us, because it was our sense that if we could hold our own qualitatively against four people who were renowned as the best in the world, they had won awards, that would kind of show, okay, so maybe we're not quite that bad. And the other thing we did, which was awesome, was we held educational seminars about barbecue. And we invited all of our toughest critics to become panelists. And we figured once we gave them the microphone, which is a form of hospitality, keep your enemies close, maybe they would sort of lighten up on us a little bit, because there's nothing a restaurant critic likes more. They won't admit it, but they like the microphone. And so it was kind of an accident that, despite the fact that first year it was pouring rain and probably about 50 degrees outside and 48, 50 degrees in the rain in New York. This was Memorial Day weekend. It was not supposed to be like this. New Yorkers' noses worked, because one thing you learn is when it's really wet outside, the smell travels. And through all those droplets of rain, and it was jamming, and it was so successful that, now it's now in its 13th year, just finished, and it attracts about 125,000 people a year. It outgrew our ability to run it, so it was acquired by a fantastic group out of Texas. But it's a great tradition, and it proves that, I guess Blue Smoke was successful, because now we have a good 25 really awesome competitors in the city, because the barbecue scene has heated up so much in New York.
Well, congratulations. And I have to say thank you for the entire community of New Orleans for the incredible things that you and your employees did for us 10 years ago when Hurricane Katrina came along. And you just stepped up to the plate, and you were one of the first people down here looking to see how you could help us. The working at Dookie Chase Restaurant, really digging deep to see what could be done. And there was so much that needed to be done. And from the very first moment, I felt like, well, Danny Meyer's got us covered, so it's going to be okay.
I'm going to tell you a quick story. I came down very soon after Katrina with Share Our Strength on a Hinges of Hope tour. And it was just the most moving experience. I was speechless when I came back from that. And so that moved us into action. a team of ours, probably 20 people strong, from Union Square Hospitality Group, asked how they could help, because I told the story. And JetBlue stepped up, offered to fly everybody down here for free. I'm not exactly sure who put them up, but I didn't get a very big bill for that. And to this day, one of my happiest mementos is a photograph of our team standing in front of Dookie Chase with Leah Chase, having spent a handful of days helping to rebuild the restaurant. And what's even fonder is that I would say that 80% of the people in that photograph are not only still with Union Square Hospitality Group, but have become the greatest leaders in our company, including Randy Garuti, the CEO of Shake Shack, and the kind of person whose heart said, I've got to be in New Orleans. It kind of helps me end our interview exactly how we started it. Those are the kind of people you want on your team.
Danny Meyer, founder and CEO of Union Square Hospitality Group. Danny Meyer hires only the best and brightest in the business. Thibodeau's own Jean-Paul Bourgeois falls clearly in that category. Jean-Paul is the executive chef at Blue Smoke and Porch Light. We caught up with Chef Jean-Paul by phone to discuss his career and what it was like to grow up in Louisiana with the last name Bourgeois.
Obviously, you look at a phone book in Thibodeau or any town in Louisiana, you're going to see some Bourgeois. They have a long history and relevance. I say relevance. I mean, we're a town of 15,000 people. I have some cousins in and out of the Bourgeois family, and I like to claim some of those really what I consider famous Bourgeois, like the Bourgeois Meat Market. But you know, I think somewhere along the way we're related. I hope. Since I can remember my earliest memories, we bought our meat from Bourgeois. Now, I used to live in Labadieville, Louisiana, which is just about 15 minutes outside of Thibodeau, even a smaller town than Thibodeau. But I always went to school in Thibodeau. So whether it be after school or on the weekends, we would get everything from steak to hamburger patties to stuffed pork chops to beef jerky and boudin hogshead cheese from Bourgeois Meat Market. It's some of my earliest food memories revolve around that butcher shop.
Well, once you've eaten any of that, it's really hard to forget it. So how did a bayou boy like you end up in the Big Apple? Tell me about the travels that brought you there.
Well, it's certainly been a long road, I guess, but a very inspiring one throughout the years. And it all started in culinary school. So I went to John Falls Culinary Institute in Thibodeau. And obviously, like most culinary programs, you have externships. I took one in Atlanta, Georgia, which led me there 13 years ago, with Popeye's research and development team. You know, I was always inquisitive and wanted to make sure that, you know, I kind of covered my bases when I decided what I wanted my overall, you know, profession to be. So I went in I was a sophomore. I was 20 years old, and I moved to Atlanta for 4 months and worked in the corporate Popeye's R&D kitchen. And so that was great. I learned a lot, and I think I fry pretty good chicken now because of it. I went back to school, and then I did an exchange program with Paul Bocuse Culinary School in Lyon, France. And I think that really opened my eyes to, and I often accredit France to this because, you know, a lot like LeBron James or the Michael Jordans of the world here in America or the rock stars here in America, I find the French have that same appreciation for chefs. And it just showed me the food-centric society that a lot of French. And then I looked at myself and I said, my family is a little food-centric like that, you know. And, you know, planning your day around the meals that you have with your family and friends. And I think that's what I saw in France, not to mention all the great charcuterie, the cheese, the produce. And I just got the itch to just see more. And I always knew, and I say this till this day, that the longer I live out of the South, the more Southern I get. I graduated culinary school, got a bachelor's of science degree in culinary arts from John Falls, and I moved to California. I'd never been to California in my life, but I packed up a U-Haul trailer and I hitched it to the back of my SUV, and me and a couple friends helped me move up there. And then after that was my first sous chef job, and I took a job with Jan Birnbaum.
Well, that must have been a really lovely experience, because he's such a wonderful person to work with.
I still have a very strong admiration for Jan, because he's one of the hardest working individuals I've ever met. He's inspiring, but he was hard. He was a tough chef to work for, and he reminded me a lot of my father in that sense. My dad practiced tough love quite a bit. So did Jan. And so I grew pretty quickly as a manager, as a leader of a kitchen. Now, a very young and very green leader of a kitchen, needless to say. But, you know, I felt that connection with Jan, him being from Baton Rouge. And then, obviously, him working with Paul Prudhomme for all those years during the late 80s and early 90s, when I was being introduced to food in my neophyte stages of that culinary growth, even at a 6, 7, 8-year-old, you know, young boy, I knew who Paul Prudhomme was. You know, my dad and my mom collected cookbooks at that time. And I can remember Frank Davis and Paul Prudhomme cookbooks all over the kitchen.
So you end up in New York City somehow?
Yeah. From California, I went to St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. There would be a lot of travelers from New York and Boston and Philadelphia and so on that came down for the winter months to St. Thomas. And I'd talk to them about food, and they would say, man, you gotta get it to New York. And I kind of took that as a sign, and I started looking at apartments in New York and slowly realized that I certainly hadn't saved up enough money to move to New York, but I was going to do it anyway. I had some friends in the city that worked at Cafe Ballou at the time, and I slept on their floor for 6 months. And I took a job at the Plaza, at the Oak Room, at the Plaza Hotel. And I worked 8 months there, and I was getting pretty bored. And I found Maialino at Union Square Hospitality Group. They had been 2 months open, and right away when I walked into that kitchen, I started working. This feeling, this sensation that I had a home and that there was family around was apparent. And you know, I've been with USHG since late 2009.
Obviously, that group is very unique and very special in the owner-employee relations. Describe for us a little bit about what it's like to work for Danny Meyer and how it feels, the philosophy there. Tell us about that experience.
You know, you and I grew up with Southern hospitality, and that may mean different things to different people. What it means to me is that you are welcome to come into a house unannounced, take off your shoes, sit down for dinner with us, shuck corn if that's what we were doing in the under the carport in the driveway. When I started buying in and learning about this idea of enlightened hospitality and how we should treat people, and I think that enlightened hospitality, and this is part of the business of hospitality quotient or HQ, is how do you use hospitality in your everyday life? And that's what I think the beauty is about enlightened hospitality, is that, it has a direct correlation between coworkers and bosses and that relationship. But ultimately, it's how we should treat each other every day, whether you're a stranger on the street or whether you're a coworker that you work side by side with. And that's really this pretty amazing idea when you inject it into a restaurant and you inject it into an overall culture.
Can you give me a specific example of how you applied your hospitality quotient in some incident?
Yeah, I mean, so as you may know, Blue Smoke and I have gone through in a kind of evolving changes from being mostly like this strictly barbecue restaurant to me coming in and, you know, pushing the envelope about what Southern food meant to New Yorkers and, you know, how we can do barbecue a little differently to make it our own, to make it Blue Smoke Barbecue. But with those changes, when you have a 12-year business that has guests who are repeat guests, there's going to be some concerns, and you're going to hear it. In this day and age with social media, it's very easy to hear those concerns from people. OpenTable, Yelp, TripAdvisor, Google, Facebook, all that. And so what Danny had taught me a long time ago is to listen to your guests and listen to what they're telling you. Obviously, you have to have some convictions, right? You have to have some beliefs. But one of the things that I started doing, so I get reports every day from Battery Park, Jazz Standard, and 27th Street on 6 different social media platforms about what people commented. Good, bad, they give whole, like, number of stars, and sometimes they leave the email, sometimes they leave their phone number, sometimes they leave both. If you give me a contact, whether it's a phone number or an email, I'm gonna contact you back. First thing I do every morning is I email the guests who had come in the night before who left their contact. Recently, it's been very, very positive, but when we first started, there were some hard knocks, and there were people who didn't like some of the things I did, and I would email them and say, you know, I still do today, value their opinion a tremendous amount. Whether I believe they're right or wrong is irrelevant. We call it being on your guest's side. And it's letting them know that their voices are being heard and that we're going to do our best to make it right with them. The truth is that your guests are telling you something, and then you have a resource to better listen to them, and then even better, respond to them. As a business operator, as an executive chef, as a leader, as somebody who tries to practice humility and humbleness, I think it's like part of my job description to be that voice for Blue Smoke and to have that connection with our guests.
Jean-Paul Bourgeois, executive chef of Blue Smoke and Porchlight in New York City.
When the flame dies, smoke gets in your eyes.
How do you cook with a salt block? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you cook with a salt block? Maybe the better question is, why? Salt blocks are made from Himalayan pink salt from deep within the ancient Himalayan mountain range of Pakistan. There, they've remained protected from pollution and impurities for centuries, making them perhaps the cleanest, purest salt in the world. Salt blocks are natural cooktops and serving platters all in one. They can be heated to high temperatures and used to sear food. They can also be used for roasting in the oven, and can be chilled and used to serve sushi, cheeses, and other cold foods. They're quite beautiful as well, and easily obtained in any gourmet shop today. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Himalayan salt blocks can cook up some real Louisiana eats. Established in 1837, Delmonico's Restaurant in New York City is America's first ever fine dining restaurant. A myriad of American standards like lobster Newburgh, chicken a la King, and baked Alaska were all created at Delmonico's. Sales and marketing director Karen Serafin and executive chef Billy Oliva were in New Orleans recently to help our own historic dining institution, Antoine's, celebrate their big 175th anniversary. I had the honor of speaking with Karen and Chef Billy to get the scoop on Delmonico's 178-year-old history.
The restaurant opened, originally was, the intention was to just be a little pastry shop. The Delmonico's brothers came here from Switzerland, and originally their plan was just to have a little, like a little cafe where they would serve like bonbons and liquor and little pastries. When they came to the United States from Switzerland, they were astounded to find out how barbaric the Americans really were, because there was no such thing as a restaurant. The only place that you could have a meal was either at an inn or a tavern, and you had to have whatever the innkeeper was preparing that day. So if you didn't feel like having a pot roast at 4 o'clock, there was nowhere to eat. You just went home. And they couldn't believe what they were seeing in the U.S. So they said to themselves, you know what, let's, you know, gather our money. They had $20,000, which was quite a bit of money back then. And they decided to actually open up the first restaurant, because in Europe, there were many, many restaurants and wonderful hot cuisine and terrific wines, and none of that existed in the United States. And so that is how the original restaurant started, that is Delmonico's. We've been in business for 178 years.
So Karen, how did the dishes get their names? I mean, Newburgh, a la King, Alaska, like what's all that about?
The Delmonico brothers were very fond of naming their dishes after customers. I think the most fascinating one is the one that involves lobster Newburgh. There was a sea captain, Captain Wenberg, who used to be a frequent customer of Delmonico's. And he used to come to the restaurant, and every time he came, he would always bring a lobster with him after his fishing expedition. And he would ask the chef to create a special dish. And the chef would create this amazing dish, and they finally ended up putting it on the menu because it was so popular, and they named it Lobster Wenberg. And it's a very, very popular dish. But unfortunately, one day, the captain, sea captain, and the chef had a falling out, and they had a very big argument, and the chef was so angry with him that he said, we're taking the lobster off the menu. And the guests were up in arms because it was a very, very popular item, and they kept asking him, please put it back, please put it back. So they did put it back. However, they changed it from Wenberg to Newburgh, so that it wasn't recognizable and he wasn't given credit. And that's how that dish got named.
I would love it if you would actually take us through the front of the house experience at Delmonico's. So you've never been to Delmonico's before, and you arrive at the appointed time. What's your experience going to be like?
Well, when you walk down the street and you first see the facade of Delmonico's, it's a very impressive image because, first of all, you see these wonderful grand pillars, and they're from the ruins of Pompeii. And they're said to be good luck if you rub them. So sometimes you see people walking in and out of the restaurant rubbing the pillars. And then you open the front door, and you're greeted with this, you know, very expansive, beautiful dining room that has a very classic, elegant feel, but at the same time doesn't feel old. It feels very welcoming, and you feel like you're sort of in this very magical space. We have restored it and renovated and redesigned while still keeping the, you know, classic elements of it, but also staying contemporary. Off of the main dining room, we have a bar that screams old New York, very Wall Street. Lots of people that are in the Wall Street arena join us at our bar after work, where we also serve during the day and in the evening a less formal menu. And that's something that we introduced about 6 or 7 years ago, so that, you know, if you didn't want to have a very formal experience and you wanted to have something a little bit less formal and more casual, we offer that option as well. And then on our lower level, we have incredible private dining rooms, because we do a lot of private dining, especially because we're located in the heart of Wall Street, just steps from the New York Stock Exchange. We're in the heart of huge financial industry in New York.
Now that we know what Delmonico's looks like, what about the food? Here's executive chef Billy Oliva to discuss Delmonico's food then and now. I read your bio, and I just really want to hear your story, because it fascinates me that you knew you wanted to work in restaurants and be involved with food when you were just 12 years old, and how providential that it was even so close by to where you are today.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I kind of went full circle. 12 years old. My brother was the general manager at Francis Tavern. My dad passed away real early, so it all kind of happened pretty quick. I was off school for the summer. My brother brought me to work and says, you're going to work in the restaurant. You're going to wash dishes. You're going to peel potatoes. And I think I was there for about a day, and I saw a guy flambe a dish, and I said, that's what I want to do.
So you are a Culinary Institute graduate, though. You went to the Culinary Institute of America at Hyde Park. What happens next in your career?
Well, right out of college, I went to work for the Lovanos family. They have Oceana in Midtown Manhattan, and it was Rick Moonen, who I spent about a year with working in the different Lovano family restaurants. From there, I left there and went into the city and hooked up back with my brother at a restaurant that was called Harbor Lights, and that was right across the river from the River Cafe. And matter of fact, there I worked with John Loughran, who at one point was the executive chef at the River Cafe. He worked under David Burke.
This, to me, is the thing I'm the most curious about, because the Delmonico's menu, just like the menu at any of New Orleans' classic restaurants, especially Antoine's, there are the absolute, just benchmark dishes that you can't mess with.
The classic dishes are the hardest dishes to work with for a few reasons. One, I get bored really quick. Two, New York is so fast-paced. You know, you blink your eye and there's a new food trend out. You know, whether it's black garlic, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, there's always something new. So to be current and to be in the whole mix, you need to have a portion of the new as well. So, you know, a lot of those dishes were invented by Charles Ronhoeffer, who they say was maybe the first celebrity chef. And, you know, you can't change those, but you can try and make them better. And, you know, maybe little different cooking techniques that we have available to us today that weren't available back then. You know, a dish like chicken a la quine, I always try what I try and do in any of the restaurants. I don't want you to be able to duplicate anything that we do in your house. You know, I want you to come there and say, wow, this is unbelievable. So like for that dish, we've changed it up. We make a farro pasta. We kind of eliminated the noodles and we went to farro, a little bit healthier farro pasta. Now we have all kinds of great seasonal mushrooms available to us. I think right now is lobster mushrooms. Burgundy truffles are around as well now. So we always try and change it up that way. The chicken at the moment we're cooking, and I think this one is going to stay for a while because it's really working well. So we're doing a version when we cook the chicken, we cook it like a brick chicken, only we're using a Himalayan salt brick. Yeah. So the flavor that comes through with the salt brick and the crispiness of the skin, and also it helps us with speed. So that's kind of what we do with those classical dishes. The only one we don't mess around with too much, because it's kind of hard to, is Eggs Benedict. The only thing we've changed were Canadian bacon, Black Forest ham, and I think we found that a prosciutto cotto works really well with the rosemary and the hollandaise and caviar and the truffle.
Do you think that there's anything that you have created that might have the stick-to-itiveness of some of the Delmonico's originals?
My one boss would love us to be like a classic steakhouse restaurant. And we are heavy red meat, but we are anything but we're not a classic steakhouse because we do so much more. But he wanted some bacon because it's a big thing in New York, bacon, just grilled, seared bacon as a side dish, as an appetizer. So I said, okay, we're going to play around with some bacon. So we got in some pork belly and we cured it, we smoked it, and it took us about 6 weeks to get it where we wanted to get it. And that has kind of taken off in Delmonico's. We do about 20 pork bellies a week that we start to cure to keep them going. It cures for about 7 to 10 days. We smoke it for about 12 hours. Then it's packaged up and sous vide for 2 days at about 140 degrees. So it's like butter when you eat it. We finish it with an aged maple that's aged in bourbon barrels for about 2 years. So really good. So maybe that is one of the dishes that seems to be taken off and might stick around for a while.
I will say, I think that dish has legs, because I'm just going to, in the future, refer to that as Billy's Bacon. So
That's it. That's kind of what it is on the menu now. And it was one of the owners who said, you have to say Billy's Bacon. I wanted to say Billy's Bacon.
So I just want to say thank you so much for making time during your visit to talk with us about, oh, what an amazing institution. I'm so honored.
Believe me, I'm going to be coming back a lot more.
That was executive chef Billy Oliva and sales and marketing director Karen Serafin of Delmonico's Restaurant in New York. Until I had the pleasure of meeting Delmonico's chef Billy Oliva and Karen Serafin, I had no idea what Chicken a la King was really supposed to be. I've been making something I call Chicken a la King for years, cooking up a cheese sauce spiked with a little sherry, then adding green peas, sautéed mushrooms, and leftover roasted chicken, serving it on toast. Boy, was I wrong. The original dish, as prepared at Delmonico's restaurant where it originated, has no cheese in it at all. And pimento peppers have been a must from the start. I sweet-talked Chef Billy out of his version of the recipe. He uses a Himalayan salt block to cook the chicken and then makes a sauce with heavy cream, lots of butter, chanterelle mushrooms, fresh sweet peas, and piquillo peppers. And here's the kicker. He serves it at Delmonico's, topped with a slice of foie gras. Ooh la la. You can find Chef Billy's recipe on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com and at wwno.org. And don't worry, I've included my version too, if you'd like to whip up something fast and easy without indulging in those luxe ingredients. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. On Tuesday, November 3rd, our friends at Brady's Wine Warehouse are hosting the next Louisiana Eats and Cooks Club at their amazing store on the corner of Calliope and OCH. We'll be cooking from my new book, The Toujacks Restaurant Cookbook, revealing recipes and stories from the city's second oldest restaurant. Each dish will be served with an expertly paired wine selection. You'll find the link for tickets on the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's website at southernfood.org and on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week as we tour the massive, historic Domino Sugar Refinery with Environmental and Quality Control Manager Fred Goodrow.
So what you're looking at there is our powerhouse. We generate enough electricity to run a small city, about 11 megawatts of power.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Sean Johnson.
come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studio at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.